Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mark. Another episode, and I'm looking forward to this chat. Ortho Joe, I've got my little cup here. Actually, I'm on my second cup, to be truthful. But anyways,
you're ahead of me, as always.
Yeah, an early start to the morning. You know how it goes.
We had you up late last night doing a webinar for the journal, which I really appreciated.
So it was a great session.
Why you need the other cup.
Hip fractures are always going to be, I think, an unsolved problem. But today, it's a bit beyond the hip fracture. And, you know, in fact, what I'd like to do, if I could, is go back to an oldie but a goodie, which is, do we need to really be pushing large clinical trials? And I know for a lot of the listeners and the viewers, they say, yes, we've been saying that for decades. But the problem is when we continually look at evidence and data, we come back to the same circular issue. So we can continue to talk about it, or we can, I guess, start thinking about how we're going to really truly solve this problem. And this one particularly was triggered by an ACE report that's come out. It was a highlight paper also that was presented at this recent June meeting of the Canadian Orthopedic Association. So I thought it'd be worth sharing with you and getting your insights on this. And the title of this particular study is called "The Fragility of Statistically Significant Findings from Randomized Controlled Trials in Hip and Knee Arthroplasty." If there's one area where we think we should be able to get lots of patients, it would be in this area. So it was interesting to me to understand really the scope of the challenge here. So just to remind again, everyone, what we're talking about, the fragility index, and let me just state this, is a method for evaluating the robustness of statistically significant findings from randomized controlled trials. And this goes beyond the p-value and beyond the 95% confidence intervals that we normally do. If a study has a sort of dichotomous outcome, like infection or no infection, revision or no revision, those studies can be evaluated using this sort of study. So this basically means, in this case, is that the fragility index is defined as the number of patients in one arm of that trial that would have to have a different outcome to change the results of the trial from statistically significant to non-significant. And this is all what this review did. So they looked at a number of randomized trials in the area of arthroplasty. They looked for those trials that actually met the criteria of having a dichotomous outcome. They had about 34 randomized trials in this particular review. Average sample size, about 100 patients, which is also, I think, an important variable here. So take a guess, Mark, what the fragility index was in arthroplasty trials. How many outcomes would have to switch from just one way to change the results of that trial from statistically significant to non-significant?
Well, I would say with an average N of 100 or so, it probably wouldn't be any more than two or three patients.
Actually, it's one patient. So you are being overly optimistic on what it would take. So in this particular case, one patient. But here's the point. That's, if it's not startling, it should be. And I think this gets back to the challenge. Now, we can argue and say, well, this is just a problem that's happening in arthroplasty. One thing I will just add before I get your overall take on this is there's been reviews done in the past. There's a review by Kahn et al. That looked at sports medicine. And again, they looked at 48 sports medicine studies, randomized trials, and the average fragility index was 2. We've seen it in shoulder arthroplasty, where the average fragility index was 1. We've also seen it in pediatric orthopedic trials, where the average fragility index was 3. And orthopedic oncology has suggested an average fragility index of 2. So I don't think this is, you know, any one specific area, but I think orthopedics, and I would argue to say surgery as a whole, will have to contend with the fact that we may be in some ways misleading ourselves by thinking that the randomized trials we're conducting are in fact definitive evidence when they are 100 patients.
Yeah, so basically it's a problem with small sample size, right? You eliminate this problem by having 1,000 patients instead of 100 patients, right?
Well, yeah, you're right. So, I mean, if you think about, it's about, well, sample size in this particular context influences the number of outcomes. So you're absolutely right. If you have, you know, the more outcomes you have, the more outcomes it would take to flip from one side to the other, which makes it less fragile. But you're absolutely right. So you could, in theory, have a small trial with lots of outcome events. Could happen, but we don't typically see that, right? It's typically few outcomes.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Maybe that I'm totally wrong in thinking about this, but doesn't the issue of pooling results in a meta-analytic approach eliminate this issue?
So, absolutely. So, if you think about why combining study results through statistical analysis was so powerful, is because it kind of simulated in many ways, and that's how I always envisioned it, is that you're simulating the ability to have conducted a single large trial. So you added way more sample, way more outcomes, and you added more precision, which meant, you know, your confidence interval, your uncertainty become narrower and narrower. The downside, though, is you add a ton more, quote, heterogeneity and, you know, and a bunch of other biases because you can't control for all those issues between studies. So all that between study variability, hard to eliminate that, right? And that's why people say, you know, sometimes you're trying to pool apples and oranges. It came up last night in our, you know, in a webinar on hip fractures saying, well, you know, can you really pool studies from 1968 and 2021? Can you really do that? There's so many differences. And they're right, right? That becomes the challenge.
Yeah. And then the issue that we discussed last night is when you have one very, very large trial, that it's going to totally dominate the results of any meta-analysis that's done. So just to be clear, you're saying that there's no doubt that a very large trial is better than pooling the results of multiple small trials.
I will tell you that that was the question that was asked to me in my master's thesis events back in the late 1990s, where at that time, Jack Hirsch, who's done a lot for, you know, perioperative, you know, thromboembolism work, had said, what's more important, a meta-analysis of 1,000 trials? I mean, a meta-analysis of many trials that add 1,000 patients or a single large trial in terms of overall bias and validity. You know, at that moment, I thought, oh, geez, this is a trick question. But it really wasn't. A single large randomized trial always trumps, for the most part, caveats, a meta-analysis of the same number. Now, what's better than a single large trial? A meta-analysis of many large trials. We don't have that luxury so much in orthopedics, I would say, but I can tell you that in medicine, there are areas, cardiovascular being one of them, where they have conducted very large meta-analyses with very large data sets. It's interesting also, if you look at other journals, Mark, New England Journal of Medicine, if you've ever gone through their table of contents, and I suspect you have, they don't publish meta-analyses for that reason. They have a considerable degree of concern about the meta-analysis approach. I think broadly, I'm obviously, you know, giving my own opinion on that. These are my opinions, not theirs. But the fact that they don't publish them tells you a little bit about what they think about them.
Right. Right. Well, let me force you to get a little bit more practical for our listeners that are having to make real decisions in the clinic and in the OR. So let's just say there's a trial that comes out. I'm going to make this up now. Shoulder arthroplasty that suggests that it's a trial of 100 subjects. 50 of them had vancomycin powder put in the wound and 50 did not. And the trial shows that it is a significant decrease in deep infection rate. What should, and this is published in a major journal, maybe JBJS.
Yeah.
So with a small trial like that, how should a clinician interpret those results, and or should they include that practice in their surgical decision-making?
Yeah, I think when you see a small study, the first thing you say, well, is this the first study that I've heard about this issue, right? So oftentimes there's that initial innovation study that's getting put out. And then you ask yourself, is this practical? So if I take a step back, no matter what we see in the literature, ultimately you're standing in front of your patient and you're interacting with that individual. And so evidence-based medicine from its onset was always beginning and ending with the patient. Anything else you do in your algorithm is there to inform you to a point, and more importantly, inform you and the patient. So it's always the risk-benefit ratio. If you feel that there seems to be some evidence that would support using a particular technique that you have not, let's say, and you believe that the risks of using it are so low that really it's a matter of just discussing with the patient and giving it a go. And sometimes, you know, the risk is cost, right? I'm just going to cost some money, but I don't think there's a downside to this. Then that becomes a little easier. The truth is, though, when we start becoming, I would, you know, use the word, and I've been there too, you know, zealots around, well, this randomized trial states something. Without the context of confirmatory evidence, like the thing that's interesting in clinical trials, Mark, that happens often, that doesn't seem to happen in the basic science literature, is if you take a basic scientist and they presume something, they never say it's fact. They want other groups to absolutely independent labs to say, I've proven, I've demonstrated this before anyone gives it credence or credibility. But we'll stand on a podium with a 50-patient RCT and claim that we have answered the problem and there's no need for new research, right? Yeah. We've been there, right? We're editors and reviewers sometimes, and I've been in that thing, said, well, do we need another trial? We just published one, right? And the point is, yes, we need another trial. So I would say, you know, it's hard to say what someone should do. There's no blanket right statement, but I do think it always begins and ends with the patient, and you have to make those judgments. I think the evidence should be there. And, you know, if it's there over years and it becomes almost, you know, common knowledge because there's been so many trials that have been confirmatory, that makes it much easier to use vancomycin powder, for example, than the very first pivotal trial that's come out that says, wow, there could be something to think about here. And, you know, some people will use it earlier than others. Depends on how you're, I think, wired to some degree, right? There's the early adopter mindset versus a mindset of being a bit more like, I'll wait till I see more evidence.
Yeah. Well, I think the what you point out in how we're so often standing on the podium with one trial, the first one on an issue in clinical orthopedics, and being sure, it relates to the surgeon personality, which you don't find in the basic sciences. I mean, we're people who are created to make decisions on less than perfect information. And really, when you think about it, you don't cut another human being unless you're absolutely certain that you're doing the right thing. So that's kind of where we fall back to, is that way that our personalities are constructed and the way we look at life. In fact, that's a topic for another Ortho Joe.
It is, you know, it is absolutely. And on that point, I would urge all of our viewers and listeners to continue to provide us comments. And we're getting more and more. We're getting more and more comments. We're getting, you know, more and more suggestions for topics. So really, really appreciate that. And we do listen and we read every comment that comes in. And we do think about, okay, can we add this? So if there's speakers you want us to talk to, other individuals, please let us know. I'll let Dr. Siminkowski kind of give the specifics and how you communicate with us as we end this particular session. But it's been great, as usual, chatting about a very important issue.
Absolutely important. So the way to contact us is orthojoe@jbjs.org. And it's all lowercase, will work just fine. And until the next time, Mo, I'm got to get to my second cup.
I'm on my third now. On my third. Have Cheers. A good day. Cheers.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.